This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, and it's the 17th of October 2009 here in Japan. Today I'm joined on the line once again by Mark and Josh, the hosts of the former internet radio phenomenon Piercing the Darkness, and two researchers who have spent countless hours uncovering the documents, making the connections, and naming the names behind the current technological control grid and how it's gradually subsuming the real world. They are also known by their Prison Planet forum handles Anti-Illuminati and Lord Syndicate. Mark and Josh, it's great to have you back on the program today.
Oh, it's wonderful to be back, James. Thank you for having us again.
Yes, thank you, James.
All right. Well, today I want to get into some solutions and how people can effectively oppose this global information awareness infrastructure that's all going up all around us. But I know you two are always digging up new documents and coming out with important research. So let's start with some updates and some information that you've come across lately that you'd like to get across to the listeners. And Mark, last week we were talking about the smart grid, and I understand you have some updates and some more information about that.
Yes. The key thing that I wanted to mention regarding the smart grid is that it is, in and of itself, it is a problem-reaction-solution type of an implementation. In one respect, it is a fraudulent solution to the manufactured economic crisis and how that the global elite has told everybody, through the puppet President Obama, that the American people need to be, quote, responsible, more responsible for our energy usage, and that we're, that we're being irresponsible, as a recent article appeared in California, where they want to ban so-called power-guzzling, big-screen televisions, that kind of thing, and how they're trying to, they're shifting over to, like, hybrid cars where you're going to have to plug them into electrical power sources and so forth. The whole thing is all demonization of human life, of just the very act of living, because you're hurting the earth. Shame on you for even being alive. You're hurting the earth. You have to ration your energy usage because there's not enough energy to go around and all this, and with the fake oil, the peak oil fraud and the so-called dependency on foreign oil, which is totally fraudulent, and is well known and documented in innumerable official sources by many experts and so forth. But that's the main thing. It's all about, it's propagandizing that you have to have your energy consumption monitored by the government, and that they can, they will impose greater costs on you for using it, as in the last interview that you did, based on the time that you're using things like air conditioning, if you're using it during peak hours and stuff like that. Now, that's one aspect of it. The other aspect of it is that the smart grid is inherently, because it's, they claim that it's more decentralized, okay? And they claim that that it's more, quote, secure because of the so-called decentralization, but that's actually a lie. It's actually more centralized because it puts like command and control over all of the power distribution into an enterprise architecture database that is built off of, PTEC, Promise, Agile-based software. And that enables them to, if Josh wants to comment, go ahead on that.
I was just going to say that basically it's at that command and control, for those of our listeners who are aware, would otherwise be known as C2 systems. Right. C2 meaning basically standing for command and control. You have two C's. It's quite that simple. Their naming conventions really are that simple. But that is the point, that basically they are putting this tier, C2, all of the C2 systems, combat controllers, even fall under the designation, and if you're familiar with the term and familiar with the military, those are actually personnel who report directly to the command and control level. But they have systems designated this way, and these are the actual, you could say, nervous system of, the entire gig, the supercomputer AI-type system that runs across the whole thing as a grid. And the whole thing is one unified system. And yeah, basically, I'll let you go on from there, Mark.
Correct. And the thing is that they know that it is, they know that this is inherently more susceptible to cyber attacks. It's there was an article where I believe it was at a Black Hat conference where they said that they found an internet worm that was able to attack the smart meters. Okay. Now, again, they're claiming that the smart grid is to eliminate cybersecurity issues or to mitigate them, but in fact, it's kind of a psyop. I mean, it's like, don't get me wrong, there's...
Well, let's kind of take this into proper context. It is more secure against the average Joe, like your average real Chinese hacker, your average 14-year-old kid who has nothing better to do but to mess around on his computer and, you know, learn how to play with things by breaking into stuff and, you know, doing illegal things, which there are 14-year-olds who are prone to do, and most of them are not very good at it because they're learning. But the point is that it is more secure and basically is going to become impossible for these people to get into these systems undetectably and get into these systems in the first place. Now, from a government standpoint, however, these entire systems are built from the premise that X system must have numbers, multiple access points that are backdoors into this system. So while it becomes more secure for them, it becomes less secure for the user because the user is then able to be infected by any government worm and any Trojan that they select. While, here's the key, it becomes next to impossible for the average person or the average hacker that we have now who may not be associated with them to actually be able to do anything. Because of the filtering, because of the very nature of IPv6, it allows everything they do to be traced, tracked, and filtered on the fly in real time, you see. But in the same respect, anything that is designated trusted by this entire network in real time, and only its creators and handlers can do such, or are supposed to be able to do such, basically are able to insert anything they want, which basically gives them complete control to wage the perfect false flag, because they can then perfectly forge everything, perfectly do everything in real time that pushes these, you know, trusted lists. So every computer around the world is like, well, you know, there can't ever be anything wrong with the trusted lists because these people say it's supposed to be the right way. So it must be somebody got into it. Meanwhile, the somebody out there doesn't really exist. It's complete false flag. It sets the ground and sets the stage for perfect false flags. Due to basically the whole, like you say, it's a psyop, the psychological nature of the way people have been conditioned. The whole point behind Microsoft, now they're coming out with a version of Windows that's supposedly uncrackable, you know, finally, that has actually all of the security updates and all of the things that people were complaining about from Windows 98 all the way up to Vista. It's finally there. Interesting, you know, that Microsoft now finally releases an OS that, you know, PC critics have said that it was everything that XP Service Pack 2 should have been, or Windows XP should have been. And yet, you know, Microsoft, are the people who propagated the very idea that computers are unsecure, that they're prone to viruses, that spyware is just something to be tolerated along with spam that you, the user, have to deal with instead of they, the maker of this software, being responsible for like they should have been in the first place. And that's the key. They have created this entire ideal about technology as it exists, that it is flawed, to such a degree that even a monkey messing around on their computer terminal in, I don't know, the middle of an African jungle off of a 56K modem can manage to do something that'll bring down an entire bank. Granted, if you really know what's going on, that's next to impossible. But that's the point. They have convinced everybody that this is possible. So by convincing everybody it's possible, they set the stage so that you won't believe that they themselves are doing it, because that would just be too wrong. It would go against the very nature of, you know, the trust that you've been taught to harbor for companies like Microsoft, Oracle, IBM, and all of these technology companies. You know, these are our blue chip stocks, the core of our economy at one point, even perhaps at this point in some people's minds, assuming we have an economy left. Of course, those people tend to think we do, sadly. And that's the key.
Right. Well, that's an important point, because just as in retail, you have engineered obsolescence whereby people will be forced to throw away their old goods in a few years so they can buy more. Well, here we have engineered incompetence. So Microsoft isn't so incompetent that it can't put together a stable operating system. It's that they don't want to, because it actually fosters this idea that everything is so unsafe that we constantly need the updates to protect us against these 14-year-old hackers in their mother's basements somewhere. Whereas, of course, there are stable operating systems and stable technological infrastructure, but they're just not being made available to the majority of the public so that they can inculcate this psychological dependency we have on being protected from these hackers.
Precisely. Precisely, James. That's exactly it. And that is what is so dangerous about this new coming, you know, IPv6 smart grid internet too, is that they have set people up to, you know, with this current conditioning that, you know, to allow incompetence, so that when the system goes into place that they hype as being unhackable, uncrackable, etc., and all that secure, and the people who really know this in and out know it is secure because of the existing psychological conditioning, will accept that, oh, it's possible it got hacked. Somebody just didn't do their job right. So they've created the very climate that allows that to happen, and which couldn't be farther from the truth. This new internet system is going to be, you know, based completely on secure keys. The whole system is based upon the idea that IP translation, that IPs are now going to be backed with secure certificates for the block, that, you know, in on the fly, this is all done, that it is checked that this IP is not only valid, but has a secure encrypted certificate that says, yes, it belongs to this internet service provider has been leased to X individual, and it will even be encoded, you know, to the point that in their databases, your name is encoded beside the IP that's assigned to you in their accounting. Right now, you know, they have accounting systems that basically match MAC address to IP, IPv4, and, you know, they basically track usage statistics. Well, IPv6 has gone a step further and has been engineered so that they can actually match the exact user to those IP statistics in real time. So basically, it gives them end-to-end false flag plausibility and complete, the, you know, create the system in which they are able to create any scenario they want, and you can't say a thing because they control the systems, and, well, by golly, your fingerprints, quote-unquote, your digital fingerprints in this case, are going to be all over, you know, whatever event they want to make you the patsy for.
Exactly. That's an excellent point.
Right.
I want to just add some things to that, too. There's an article, okay, it's titled Obama's Power Over Internet is Central Factor in Cybersecurity Debate. This was from thehill.com. Just an excerpt from this, okay. One of the guys that works for Bilderberg as, you know, one of their lower-level, you know, so-called subject matter experts, he's with the CSIS. Now he's had this. He's been used as the, you know, the mouthpiece for this, or the propagandist, the Joseph Goebbels of the internet, of the threat, to, the so-called threat to the internet, for like over 10 years. And a quote from this article says that others say the president should be able to take such action, in terms of where it says the scope of the president's power to direct private sector critical infrastructure information systems operators is left undefined and problematic. James Lewis, senior fellow for the CSIS, which last year issued a set of cybersecurity recommendations to Congress, likened the provision to President George W. Bush's call to shut down airlines after the attacks of September 11th, 2001. This is in reference to the president having the power to shut down the internet. And he says, quote, "It seems foolish not to have the same authority for cyberspace," he said. "It's not that the president will wake up in a bad mood one day and implode Yahoo. This would apply only to severe national emergencies. This is a great opportunity to blast us into a new level of discussion about cybersecurity," unquote. Yeah, you mean a national emergency like the global flu pandemic? You mean that national emergency, Mr. Lewis, that your boss has engineered? I mean, that guy right there, everybody that's in the CSIS, I mean, these people are just heavily integrated into the government. They're all enemy terrorists, traitors, and they need to be arrested and indicted for treason right now. They're criminals, and they're getting ready to attack the U.S. and carry this out globally. There's one thing I want to see what Josh has to say about this. From some research I did, I found that from my deduction, I was able to determine that the cyber attacks that occurred in Estonia in 2007 were actually a false flag. And incidentally, after the fact, a company that took over this, that was replaced or that acted like a filter in between Estonia for anyone that visits their websites in that country, are all going through Akamai Technologies. Now, I think Josh may know something about that company that would be rather interesting. You want to comment on Akamai?
Akamai. I guess you can call it Akamai, too.
Okay.
However you want to pronounce it. Okay. the Estonia incident, that's interesting because it goes in the whole Yugoslavia thing, and actually a friend who from that region who, actually got to witness a lot of that interesting filtering firsthand. Akamai, is a content distribution network. As a matter of fact, they are the content distribution network. Not to say that there aren't other companies that try, but these are the only people, or I should say, this is the only company that provides this on an enterprise scale. They pretty much hold the monopoly on this market in the enterprise. They have Akamai cache servers at every major ISP hub, on every major internet, peer point. They then have other servers at every major IT company that uses them for hosting. And they manage the entire service. Basically, what that means is, and as a matter of fact, their first biggest clients, and this is who really put them on the map, would be Apple, Yahoo, which Overture Networks, which is also Disney, Go, CNET was also a part of this. And these were basically the original key players that made Akamai or gave it its funding. Akamai then basically grew and grew because it was the key choice for people wanting to spend less money on bandwidth with their local ISP and just basically allow Akamai to make up the difference and, pay them, they get paid also through advertising, but they also make, there are other deals that they do direct actual contracts with major companies on major, major hosting projects. One of the key things about Akamai is you cannot get an Akamai cache into your server room unless you have at least a T3 or better. And you have to have more than likely at least two of them. And then it has to be worth Akamai's while for them to put one there. And if not, then you're going to pay them a buttload of money just to get an Akamai cache. And we're not talking in the thousands. We're talking in the millions usually. yes, they are that big, and that's what they do. They basically allow your ISP to host the videos that come off YouTube. Well, not necessarily YouTube, because that's Google Cache. So Google does that on... Yes, there is... Let me back up a minute. There is actually one major competitor for Akamai, and that is Google. Google is perhaps Akamai's only major competitor, but the key difference here is Google does not allow customers to cache their images. Google caches whatever the heck they want in their servers. And just like Akamai or just like Google, depending, basically the same in this respect. They both have servers at every major ISP that has a cache. And what this allows them to do is it allows everybody on this ISP to grab this video off of the ISP's local servers. Therefore, they don't pay high exchange rates by taking bandwidth from other ISPs. So it really does work out in the long run for the ISPs. It is more economical. But at the same point, it costs a lot of money, and Akamai is really making a killing here and charging buttloads of money to basically perform an unnecessary service that should be unnecessary. But, that's a moral discussion for later. Point being is what happened there, and because Akamai has control of these caches, basically they were, given orders from the locality there to filter things. And since, basically that means they filtering content from the time Yahoo, Apple, iTunes Store, well, there wasn't an iTunes Store back then, but, content in general, anything that was a video or a picture, more than likely was at that point in time was mostly stored on our caches. Still is. So, things just wouldn't show up. Local news that was run on the local news station's would be put on an Akamai cache there to be distributed worldwide. Well, lo and behold, the fact that it never leaves Estonia borders and, basically cut them off. They were cut off from the rest of the world, and the rest of the world was cut off from them. And it was all thanks to the ability of Akamai being the key player holding all of that content, and, because of such, it was able to be filtered. And, for the layman, basically what this does is it gives central key points that distribute content, you see. So if you're thinking from a military standpoint, all you have to do to take down all of these videos, YouTube videos, you'd take down the Google cache if it was a YouTube, but, basically Disney videos, Paramount, IBM, Ford, General Motors, the list goes on as to who uses Akamai for their content, as most major enterprises do. So it would be very easy to shut down. At this point, all one would really have to do to filter all of your content would be to go into the Akamai Masters, root, go into one of their servers, you go on the operating system, log in as root, because it's a whole central network, the whole thing's centralized, go into their core, log in, propagate that, these are the filters that apply, these are a master global filter for everything, click. And all of these videos, all of this content no longer shows up. Same thing with Google, except it'd be from Google, initiated. Pretty much same process. And boom, it no longer shows up. Google already does this, so do Akamai. They just don't do it on a massive scale because, if all of a sudden we woke up one day and, oh my gosh, Disney's gone, New York Times is no longer having, things show up, all of the images are missing, MSNBC, I can't get my live video feed. If all that happened at once, people would notice, so they filter little things that, the people that notice, but, the average person is like, oh, it just expired, it just got old. So it allows them plausible deniability because they are now, when they filter things, they filter them on a you know, on a singular basis, case by case, in such a way that, you know, it doesn't look that intentional. Yet, in places like Yugoslavia and places like China, here's a perfect example. Akame has, you know, all of these caches throughout China. They are regularly filtered. It is basically part of the deal that Akame had to sign along with Yahoo and Google in order to allow them, their servers and their websites and their content to be distributed in China, is that the Chinese government is allowed to filter anything. The same filters are in place throughout the whole system. The only difference is you know, here is essentially what's being filtered for at this point, but, you know, the fact that it's not being done to the extreme that it is currently in China. Now, you know, with the infrastructure being the way it is, you know, you could wake up tomorrow and it would be just like China, and all it would take is one little, you know, order from somebody on the top saying, oh, we got to filter this. This is bad for national security. Yep, this is illegal under this. This is terrorism. Patriot Act allows for a lot of this stuff, but, you know, there are loopholes that would make it a little harder to do right now. So, you know, assuming they can push the legislation through, the infrastructure exists, but it's all basically, you know, about 5 minutes worth of work, and the entire Internet, as we know it, would be gone.
Right, and just on regarding what you just said there, Josh, there's a continuation on that article I was reading. I'll just quote from it. It says, Senator Joe Lieberman, chairman of the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee, introduced a bill in April directing the Department of Homeland Security to work with other intelligence agencies to create a plan to protect critical electric infrastructure from cyber attacks. Companion bill has been introduced in the House by Representative Benny Thompson, chairman of the House Homeland Security Committee. Nojim said that the CDT largely supports the other cybersecurity bills. Quote, it's about strengthening FISMA and getting the government's own house in order, which is a prerequisite to any discussion about what the government should require of the private sector. So basically, right. In this sense, FISMA would be the counterpart, you know, for the Internet, like to what the Patriot Act is to so-called terrorism, right? Now, there's another important thing that I got to mention about the cybersecurity thing. Bouncing back for a second on the smart grid, this is very important. There is an audio MP3 file that is available to download from the CSIS website that features a speech that was given by General Victor E. Renard Jr., the commander of Northern Command. In his own words, he stated that he was very, you know, quote, very concerned about the energy delivery systems in the United States. And that basically what he was saying was that it was going to be Northern Command's responsibility to, quote, secure the smart grid. Okay? So there you have that aspect of it. You're bringing in the smart grid, then it's like, oh, we need cyber, you know, we can't get rid of the smart grid because of the economic crisis and our energy crisis that we're in. So since we've rolled the smart grid out, we've got to put all the cybersecurity stuff in here. Oh, and that's gonna legitimize NORTHCOM military troops to have a greater presence throughout the United States, because they're going to be responding to false flags that they're going to be carrying out themselves, or their military-industrial complex counterparts like SAIC or Booz Allen Hamilton or MITRE or Air Force Research Laboratory or Air Force Cyberspace Command or Alexander Levis at his System Architectures Lab, where there's part of his own website now. Get this, I mean, Alexander Levis and the principal from Booz Allen Hamilton is running a cybersecurity center at George Mason University. I mean, the very engineer of like every false flag since 1995, one of the collaborators, one of the engineers, is going to be involved in, is quote unquote, protecting the United States in conjunction with a national security agency. You can't make that up. I mean, it's off the charts. So they're trying to legitimize that. And nobody, you know, these guys, they don't think that anybody's going to figure it out. And now you have, as I mentioned last week, and Josh, I would like his input on this. There was a TV show on it, you know, NCIS, where they were showing that, and it was also on American Dad, too. There was another thing like this, too, where it showed, they claimed that Al-Qaeda or the Taliban or just anybody, you know, an American citizen could hack into an unmanned aerial vehicle and use and override the flight controls and carry out terror attacks with it, you know, and blow things up with it and so forth.
Yes, anybody can do that who has the code keys, and then they have the general's code keys, and the code keys above the general, and they manage to get all of these pass keys, and then they manage to get into the central server and convince the AI itself that it needs to stop controlling this UAV and hand it directly over to this person who has no credentials, nothing that is escalatable, you know, internally above a guest. Yes, it's supposed to give them God privilege. Right. Yeah. Uh-huh. That's about as possible as non-genetically modified pigs growing wings and flying. Okay? There are too many safeguards in place for that to ever happen. Number one, you would have to have control of all the DNS root servers in the world. Number two, you would have to get a DPS transceiver encoder, which are classified, which are handed out to, you know, to people in units, you know, on missions that, you know, check these things in and out with, you know, the CO hands them to them. They're accounted for. They basically, you know, are beyond more classified, you know, than a nuclear weapon because these things can guide nuclear weapons. Hello! I mean, not only is there, an actual inventory on the nuclear weapons, but the actual GPS transmitters attached to these things. Sorry, transceivers. They are quite different than the transceivers that are in every single cell phone or your average GPS little handheld. No. These GPS transceivers are all set to a specific atomic clock. They all have the exact same atomic time. Now, basically what I am disclosing here, which is available through Freedom of Information Act and is somewhat public knowledge, although you have to dig and dig and dig, and as one point was classified, is the fact that that to even get into the DARPA network, you have to have a GPS transceiver that basically gives you a reading, and it gives you a time reading along with, you know, the coordinates. And this time reading is based upon an atomic clock. And all of these transceivers are basically tuned to that. Anyone who knows anything about, you know, molecular physics understands that means that all of these clocks are built off the same exact isotope, which would mean that the DoD would want to keep this isotope in some sub-basement in the Pentagon or Cheyenne Mountain, perhaps, or wherever the heck they would keep this thing, that no one else could get to it, because this very isotope is the essential code key to their DARPA systems. And without it, you don't get in. If you're caught trying to steal one of these things or take one of these things off of the DCAT or the satellite system's uplink, you're shot on the spot. And these keys are the only way into their network. That's the only way to get into the network. And then not only do you have to be able to get into the network, but you have to have master admin privileges over, you know, UAVs, over specific UAVs, over this specific squadron of the UAVs coming that are assigned to your specific unit that you have been given specific control over. If you don't have these permissions and the computer, you know, be able to give them to you is impossible without intentionally having them put there by a general prior, you know, or a commanding officer prior to a mission, having coordinated with like three or four other divisions, because you're having to deal with, you know, the IT division, you're actually having to deal with the future combat systems portion of the military and those divisions, and you have to get them to work with your team that has to work with your CO's team to find out what your mission is so important that it requires a UAV for. So basically, yeah, you would have to have, you would have to literally be a four-star general to be able to outright just take control of a UAV. Just by the very nature of the way the permissions are set in their computer systems.
So what you're saying is that a 14-year-old with his Nintendo Wii controller probably isn't going to get control of one.
Exactly.
All right.
Precise.
Yeah.
It'd be impossible. Yeah.
Exactly. All right, well, let's shift gears for a moment, because I understand that, that Josh, you have some updates about the flu pandemic.
Absolutely. Yeah, a couple things I'd like to bring up. A buddy of mine recently forwarded me an article, and I was actually mentioned this to James a little earlier before the show, but Russell Blaylock has an article out as to what to do if you are forcibly vaccinated, and this entire article may very well save your life. He discusses various methods and steps that you can take, you know, if you know you're going to be vaccinated, and upon being vaccinated as to what to do to increase your chances of surviving being vaccinated. And I recommend that everybody, you know, go Google Russell Blaylock. His website's pretty readily available, and I know it's syndicated by several other, you know, places on the web. Another site that actually has some very interesting information that is discussed about flu and flu immunity and how to build your immunity to that would be Dr. Merkula. He is a homeopathic physician who does quite a bit of research and is very well world-renowned for, you know, his skills as a homeopathic physician. Couple little tips that I'd like to bring up that people can, supplements and things that people should look into and start taking, assuming that you do not have any allergies to said things or that sort of thing, and you always may, and you always want to consult your homeopathic physician if, you know, in question before doing any of these, if you have any questions. I am not a doctor, so just had to put that out there, so, you know, for, you know, legal reasons, all that good stuff. But, so this is not medical advice, but that said, things that you can start doing. It was proven that during the flu pandemic of 1917 that one of the only things and one of the few sections of the populations throughout the world that were found to not be affected or to not have deaths from this were populations that fed upon European black elderberry. They baked it in pies, they ate the bark, that sort of thing, you know, used for lots of different things. You can actually find concentrated black elderberry supplements at your local Whole Foods, or your local health food store should have them. Nature's Way has a great, you know, has a great capsule, and, you know, you can just take them regularly as directed. Those are really good. That's actually proven. One of the other interesting things is, and we'll get into this in a little bit, there's a series of drills put together by the government called Strong Angel for exactly this type of thing, and basically, you know, incorporates teleworking and getting the country back on its feet in a pandemic scenario, basically, or in a crisis scenario. But we'll get into that in a minute. But one of the key players in that, one of the head doctors, actually mentioned that there are various mushrooms that grow in the southwestern parts of Arizona and California that those native peoples actually had eaten. And it was proven that during the 1918 and 1917 pandemic that these Indian tribes who ate this particular type of mushroom, and it escapes me exactly what the name of that is, perhaps Mark can fill that in here in a minute, they were shown to actually gain immunity to the flu and were the some of the only people, well, out of all of the Native Americans, were the only section of Native Americans not to report a single death. And per, and amongst Americans in general, one of the only communities not to report any fatalities from the flu pandemic. Now, the key thing here is, and this is the thing about what kills from, you know, in this flu. Okay, so, excuse me, I'm a little tongue-tied. Been, you know, it's been a long day. Okay, the key here is that basically the flu, it comes around and people get the flu on a regular basis. Usually the people who die don't die from the flu. They die from the complications that arise because your immune system becomes overstimulated and becomes burnt out. And when that happens, pneumonia sets in and people die. And, you know, other bacteria is able to take hold because your immune system has become so depleted that, you know, it can't deal with this. Now, you know, I forget the exact medical term, but basically it's when your immune system becomes overstimulated. Now, you know, many flus are able to stimulate your immune system to a certain degree, but the average healthy person who gets enough vitamin D, you know, gets their right vitamins, you know, eats well and that sort of thing, you know, is usually going to get over it. Well, the thing about the 1917 pandemic flu and that particular strain of the flu is that it was really, really good at overstimulating the immune system so that the immune system would go into overdrive immediately upon encountering it. And they've had this strain around for a while. Now, we'll get into the origins of this current flu here in a minute, but basically, this flu would, you know, wipe entire sections of the population out, not because of the flu itself, but because of the pneumonia. The person would get, their immune system would go into overdrive, and, you know, you'd get pneumonia because it would become overstimulated, and on the crash, all of these bacteria would set in and take hold, and you would die. Now, the key to actually fighting this is taking things that build your immune system slowly. Things like echinacea and golden seal are actually not recommended because they create a hyperimmune condition where your immune system is on alert and it's releasing more antibodies, producing more white blood cells faster, that sort of thing. And it goes into that hyper condition a lot faster. Whereas if you're taking things like black elderberry supplement or these particular mushrooms that are grown, you know, that are from that part of the U.S., then your immune system actually builds things like, and vitamin D is another key factor. A lot of vitamin D is required because what it will do is it will allow your immune system to build itself over time. So naturally, it is used to having this much more of the actual white blood cells, this many more antibodies and B cells and T cells on a regular basis, so that whenever the infection comes in, you know, your body is already at X level, so that if it actually goes to, you know, the next level, not hyper level, but, you know, it increases as you get sick, as it slowly increases, it will be able to overcome it because you will have more, you know, more of a, your immune system will basically be stronger. That's basically what it does. It builds your immune system over time rather than in quick bursts the way that echinacea and things like golden seal do. And that's why things like, well, elderberry and this fungus are key, along with vitamin D. You want both kinds, vitamin D2 and D3. And another thing that is quite important these days, especially with all of the heavy metal in the air, the food, and God knows what else, is colloidal silver. You know, you can get those supplements online. You want to go through a reputable source, of course, and that sort of thing. Lastly, I want to mention one other thing that is actually quite good at killing bacteria and viruses. It is a true antiviral. It's perhaps one of the most powerful antivirals known to man. There are perhaps some things stronger, but this is one of the most powerful, and that is oregano oil. Okay, now, you know, be very careful with oregano oil because people tend to be a bit sensitive to it. I have several friends who, you know, are very much into homeopathic medicine but are very careful with oregano oil because they are sensitive to it, and it seems to be something somewhat common. So just be a little bit careful with that, but that is a very powerful antiviral and can have very useful effects in helping to combat the flu because it works directly on the virus itself. It doesn't build nor boost the immune system. It merely kills the virus. So, yeah, that's, you know, that's my little flu thing for the moment. But to throw this in there, some very interesting things about the current flu, and this is why I bring up the pandemic flu from 1918 and 1917. Now, as per various contacts of mine that actually formerly worked at Fort Detrick and now work for the CDC, the current flu that is being released has been released in two parts. And that, gosh, I'm forgetting his name.
Dr. Horowitz?
One of the, bingo, thank you. Thank you, James. Yes, Dr. Horowitz. That Dr. Horowitz's assessment of the virus is actually spot on, and that the virus itself, can, this that the first half, which was released earlier this year, contains one half of the same pandemic flu, the same flu virus that was responsible for the 1917 pandemic. It is bound to various other components of the flu using the mutagen guns, you know, the same guns that they use for genetic modification of vegetables. Well, they did this with the flu, and they've attached to it various other insect-type flus and basically created a genetically modified virus that will do exactly the way, what they want. Not only that, but it is race-specific, and this has been confirmed, and I cannot reveal these sources. They have asked me not to reveal their names, but they have said I am more than welcome to actually say, you know, repeat the conversations, that basically this flu has been designed to be race-specific and been designed to be race-specific to such a degree that any Latino or black-skinned person who does not die from it immediately, and if you will notice, the only people dying from it are either black or Latino or have those same genes somewhere in their family heritage, are the, you know, are the ones, they're the ones dying from it, but those who don't die are carriers. Basically, they become typhoid Marys. Now, what this means for the general public is, you know, you see your kid getting the sniffles. This is because the virus has mutated, and this person who, you know, hasn't died from it, you know, is, it's mutated enough that they are a carrier, and so, you know, your child gets part of it, and they're getting, you know, their immune system's being whittled down and whittled down and whittled down by this thing constantly, because it's constantly mutating, and it's constantly changing. So even though they've designed it to be race-specific, it does mutate, and that's just the nature of viruses in the wild. So it can affect and can, and has been designed to even infect, you know, white people and people of European origin, okay? And, you know, eventually, you know, their projections figure that by the time that they release the second half of this, that the virus will have mutated to the point that it will be able to actually start killing people of European origin. However, they intend to help it along. Once again, let's remember this is only one half of the 1917 pandemic flu virus. They intend to release the second half of this, basically as per my friend's exact statement, they intend it to be a Christmas present for the American people, which is, yeah, basically the New World Order's Christmas present for us all, which is quite sick and disgusting. They plan to release the other half. The other half will carry all of the activators that allow it to cease being race-specific. However, there is actually one specific race that it will not affect and will not kill, and they have done tests, and apparently people of 100% pure blood Chinese blood, non-Mongolian, as well as some Japanese, will be completely immune. Isn't that nice? However, everyone else will be experiencing at least one-third of the population, well, deaths in the population. Now, I'm actually going to get to those and where that figure comes from in a minute, because that's a very scary information source in and of itself and a very scary figure. But my friend confirms this, and I actually have, well, friends confirm this. that basically when this is released, it's going to catalyze, and when the two halves combined, and it will be quite easy to release, you know, your wonderful flu shots should help. it'll combine, and it will basically wipe out at least one-third of the population. Now, this is this comes direct to me from a friend, well, several sources. One of them used to work for the CDC, well, worked at Fort Detrick, now works at the CDC. There's another person who's still in Fort Detrick who is a mutual friend, and then there are two separate people who are retired who used to work in various military functions that I cannot discuss that also confirm this. Now, the last piece of confirmation information that comes from a completely public sector source, I believe is a company called New Beginnings. And basically, they are a division of the RAND Corporation. They have put out a document that says that they expect this winter to be a very harsh flu season, and that they expect that if this pandemic flu hits, this H1 pandemic really catches on, that they expect at least one-third of every population, you know, of the population globally to die. The only exceptions, they say, will be in places that are close to the equator that people naturally get enough vitamin D, and then people of 100% non-Mongolian Chinese blood and some Japanese, basically, you know, original Chinese-descended Japanese people, will be immune. And these are the only populations that will not see one-third in the decrease. This document and this company is quite interesting because they have been consulting with multiple enterprises globally and multiple governments. They have been charged with preparing essentially the world for this upcoming pandemic. And they are a division of the RAND Corporation. The very same RAND Corporation that helped bring you Promise and Answer and Department of Homeland Security and the ARPANET, otherwise now known as the Internet. Yes, that very same RAND Corporation. And they are the ones who are publicizing this and, taking extreme measures. In fact, there are entire provisions, you know, saying that we should expect hostile, you know, riots and things in areas that are quarantined and how to deal with quarantines. The whole nine yards, it's a very extensive set of white papers as to how governments and corporations must deal with this upcoming pandemic. And like I said, I believe the name of it is the New Beginnings document, and from the comes from the New Beginnings Corporation, which is a division of RAND.
Well, the obvious question is, why on earth is this virus being engineered to protect Chinese and Japanese?
That is a really great question. And, I've discussed this with a couple friends of mine and, you know, some people, and, you know, it really goes along with the fact, if you look at what's happening globally right now, China specifically China is being set up to be the new superpower. The U.S. is being set up to take the big fall. Our president gets a Nobel Peace Prize, yet we're denied for nothing, and yet we're denied the Olympics. Doesn't that seem a bit shady, too? You know, the global opinion of the United States hasn't changed that much, really, since Bush. A lot of people are happy about Obama, but they still, you know, believe that the United States is a bunch of warmongering assholes. Excuse my language, but yeah. and that's the thing. We've been set at this point, we have no real economy. Basically, the center of everything is moving to China. So, you know, if they all of a sudden destabilize their new superpower, and their new superpower is so destabilized by having to deal with the flu, well, then they can't rise to be, you know, the saviors, because after all, there has to be some type of savior for this vaccine. You know, it comes from, you know, it's the Chinese H5N1, you know, pandemic. It's the swine flu. So these Chinese people must have grown up with it all their lives, you see. I'm not saying this. I'm just, you know, using plausible, you know, statements that could be used for future plausible deniability. But the key is, and that's a very good question, is why? You know, I'm throwing out there possible answers as to why at this moment. The key thing is, that's a really great question that nobody has been able to answer for me without speculation.
Josh, I can interject something on that. Maybe this would answer part of the question is, what about the Chinese so-called anti-terror police that they're going to be in the U.S.? How convenient that they won't be affected.
Bingo.
Right?
Bingo. That is a logical reason as to why. That is, definitely. And, you know, doesn't involve much speculation, if any at all, because they do. They have been training. Good friend of both mine and Mark's, Jordan, found an interesting article. I have to dig it up again. Basically, it talks about these Chinese counterterrorism units that are now training in Mexico and Canada, specifically for counterterrorism situations. They are trained, they are issued Segways, you know, those wonderful little unicycle Segways, and they're issued, you know, assault weapons, and they're trained to fight homeland terrorism. Now, what the most interesting thing is, why on earth are Chinese homeland counterterrorist forces training on the borders of the United States in Mexico and Canada? Why? Why can't they just train in China? Perhaps because that's who's going to come in, like Mark said. That's exactly who they're going to use. And since these people are naturally immune, you won't have to worry about giving them some type of vaccine that you know is going to kill them and actually contains the virus. That's another little key piece here. All of these flu vaccine designed for H1N1 is not designed to actually prevent it. You know, we have a culture that is designed, that has been conditioned to believe that vaccines will save us from everything. How convenient a place for them to hide the virus. And that is actually going to be their distribution means. You keep seeing these ferrets and things die, you know, and these this Baxter cover-up and all these things, these animals that the vaccine gets tested on automatically die. You know, isn't there little, you know, warning bells that should be going off in people's heads here? And here's the thing, you know, you have enough people in the general population who, you know, are getting their flu vaccine, who don't listen to reason. People, sadly, like my dad, who are like, oh, I got my flu vaccine already, who will willingly lie down and take the vaccine. So you get at least a third of the population with that vaccine right there, and that's enough to spread it globally. I mean, just sit next to somebody. The flu's airborne. Just sit next to somebody who, you know, has been vaccinated, who now has it, you know, who just got their flu shot. They're in the incubation stage. Little do you know, you've just been incubated as well, because, you know, they're breathing out the viruses and you're breathing them in. Yeah, real simple. Real simple for that to happen in real simple distribution. And that's the point, though. You know, that would make a lot of sense. You create it so that it's race specific, so that you have a cleanup force. Because exactly, if the rest of every other population in the world has this problem, and for some reason China's immune, and you know, they can make up whatever story, then China gets to be the world's savior. Isn't that convenient? You know, they've designed their ultimate socialist society. This, admittedly, by people like Alex Jones and others, have said that China is the model for the New World Order is using. Well, now that they have their model perfectly in place, they're going to use their little, Chinese plebs. No offense to the Chinese, especially if you're one of those Chinese people who've broken away and don't consider yourself a pleb. No offense. This is, you know, not targeted at you, but the point being that on a whole, you know, they go along, and these little little soldiers will be used to carry out their orders here and be our saviors. Yes, they'll save us from all those horrible homegrown terrorists who have gone crazy with the flu. Oh, yes. You know, there's another little thing right there. There's another little piece of psychological conditioning, you know. Well, it's not so much psychological conditioning just as a natural effect. You know, people know that whenever you're sick with the flu, you have a fever, you become delirious, and people, you know, might just be prone to doing, you know, whatever when they're delirious. You know, reasonable and rational people become insane and unrational when they're delirious and have the flu. So, you know, that's a great scapegoat for many and many an instance, and many and many a false flag will easily be blamed upon crazy flu victims.
A few things I want to mention regarding this too is look at the Associated Free Press. Not long ago, they had an article that was titled "Empire State Building Turns Red Yellow for China's 60th anniversary of communism." So there's a correlation to that. Back on,
yeah, why the heck are we celebrating communism? I mean, you know, whatever happened to the Cold War? You know, weren't we supposed to be the, you know, isn't that why we went into Vietnam, Korea? Isn't that why we had the Cold War? I'm sorry. Yeah.
The other thing is, back on, we were talking about Strong Angel 3 earlier, and Josh can comment on some of this, because there's a particular video. If it's still on YouTube, you can watch it. If you just type in Strong Angel 3, like just three eyes, and look for I can just put links to this up for this podcast. But basically, there's an interview with the director of the program, Dr. Erik Rasmussen, and when you listen to what he says and watch him and so forth, it seems like he's kind of he comes off as kind of like a neutral individual. He doesn't seem like he's pro New World Order, so to speak. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. It's like, well, what is that supposed to mean? Well, what's interesting is that when you read their actual official document for that entire exercise, it's at they have their own website, strongangel3.net. There's a document called the SA3 Working Report 2006. There's an excerpt from there, which I'll read, that has a couple of things that we've been talking about all summed up into like one paragraph. And it's chapter 21, and it's called Boosting Immune Competence. Quote, "Many interesting topics not directly addressed within the Strong Angel demonstration appeared during the preparation or aftermath. As an example, one suggestion coming to us for responding to the avian influenza scenario was to increase population-based immune competency as a method for reducing epidemic spread. Several natural and inexpensive substances have demonstrated effectiveness against a wide range of pathologic agents, and this possibly was discussed with Anthony Fauci at Davos last January. The initial possibilities suggested include mushroom extracts from Phamatopsis officinalis, significant antiviral properties based on studies at the U.S. Army Medical Research Institute of Infectious Diseases, 2005, L-glutamine plus PAC, PAK, pyridoxal, ketoglutarate, standard antioxidants, and other inexpensive supplements that appear to have benefit in peer-reviewed research and are unlikely to cause harm. As far as we can see, there is not much effort expended on research toward making a vulnerable population more resistant to illness. Given difficulties in mass vaccination and mass care, such investigations seem warranted." So he's acknowledging that the people that compiled this document that are part of this program, which is, again, under the director is Erik Rasmussen, Dr. Rasmussen. He's in the Navy. He's a naval officer, medical officer, okay? He's making note of the fact that that the government wants to mass vaccinate, but is having difficulties and is making mention of natural remedies and is stating that they that investigations into why they're not why we're not being informed of such things is warranted. So why would someone that's, you know, and the thing is that's important to know is the whole exercise, this was an exercise that was interagency. It involved DHS. It involved the integration, you know, the collaboration with Northern Command. So you have someone that's involved with this that's not totally doesn't come off like he's hardcore, like, you know, death cam, this is New World Order, we're killing you. He's coming off with it like kind of an objective type of a perspective towards that. So I thought that's a very key thing in that document, and there's a lot of other interesting information in there too. And Josh, before you comment, I want you to also make, you know, comment on this too, in reference to the RAND affiliated company New Beginnings. In that same document that you were referring to, they mention the use of firefighters being used to administer vaccines because of the inherent public trust in firefighters.
Exactly. And not only do they do that, but they even go as far as to say that they will need to use firefighters and mainly firefighters because EMS and police workers will be too busy dealing with, you know, people and current situations, and that they expect that even the police's own numbers will be so overwhelmed by this that basically the firefighters will be the only ones left that they can turn to. And they also, and the other reason behind it is, as you stated, because of the existing public trust that people have for firefighters, you know. These are your average Joe. They're here to protect you. They don't want to hurt you. They just want to save you, and that's their job. And to them, that's all they're doing. You know, these people have no clue that they're going to be injecting you with something that is literally designed to kill you. All they know is that this is what's going to save you. They're not told anything else, and, you know, the average firefighter, you know, doesn't want to hear and has been conditioned not to believe, you know, mumbo jumbo, or think that, you know, the idea that vaccines are toxic is mumbo jumbo. That's the thing, you know, society readily mocks it. They put out films like Toxic Skies that, I know people have touted as being a wonderful piece, but, you know, the wife and I saw it the other day and we're like, gosh, you know, this really mitigates the whole thing. Now, you know, when people talk about chemtrails, they go, oh, like that movie Toxic Skies, yeah, that was a funny movie, man, or whatever somebody thinks about the movie. You know, they no longer are able to associate that that's really going on. You know, anything that people, that's one of the other great things. You put something in a movie like that, and basically, you discredit the subject. Because the instant it goes into a fictional movie, people will always go, oh, just like in that movie. And, you know, you try and tell them, no, but it's happening in real life. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, like in the movie, man. And they don't think about it. They don't lend it any more credence.
And absolutely, so and that happens time and again with so many different subjects, and you even see just ridiculous things like the last Starfighter or whatever, where the kid is recruited to be part of the, you know, defending the galaxy because he was good at a video game, and now of course we see that coming out with the Army recruiting people based on their performance in video game simulations and recruiting them to run these UAVs and things like that, and it happens time and time again. So how about you guys, what do you guys think about hacker movies or movies based about on hacking and cybersecurity and those types of things?
That's okay. I'll let Mark come in first, but I definitely have some things to say. Unless you want to just let me go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, actually, I'll say something regarding that. There's quite a few of them. You have Sneakers. You have The Net from 1995 with Sandra Bullock. That's a very key one right there. And then much more recently, one of the most recent ones is the one with Bruce Willis. That's Live Free or Die Hard. And I don't know if I've... okay, that too. But I don't know if I've ever mentioned this before, but anybody can do. This is very important, by the way, that everybody sees this. If you do a search for PTEC built supply chain infrastructure, if you do a search for that on Google, you'll find a video that I merged together from some official videos from Unisys talking about enterprise architecture and artificial intelligence and their integration and, you know, takeover of all systems and so forth, to where I inserted a clip from the net in there due to its total relevancy to it. It kind of helps make everything else make sense for someone that's not familiar with what this is really about. And, you know, a lot of the elements in the net with all of the identity theft and everything, you know, that's from 1995. I mean, it's like way ahead of its time and so forth. What they're basically talking about is a lot of the stuff that, well, everything that's happening now, and without saying it, they were, a lot of it was alluding to the capabilities of Promise back then, and now the successors of that. So if Josh wants to comment on that.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Well, yeah, you know, yeah. add to that, actually, I'll add a couple other things, a couple other titles. And, yeah, basically, the hackers movies themselves, which are interesting pieces of work. the whole first one is basically total fiction and, you know, does a really good bang-up job of, you know, helping to condition people to think that the average 14-year-old can get into your, you know, system and turn on the sprinklers or turn off the sprinklers in a whole school or whatever, you know, set off the fire alarms. You know, that alone is impossible for many other reasons, just because, especially those are the heat-sensitive sprinklers, you know, the ones the little metal has to melt on to set them all off. Right. It's physical fail-safe. but, you know, that's just one of the little things. You know, a lot of the other stuff in that movie is all fictionalized, and it's basically one big psyop piece. Now, we'll follow this up with another big psyop piece that is meant to demonify and glorify hackers all in one. It's a very interesting movie in and of itself. It was known as Hackers 2, but most people don't realize that it was actually a Hackers movie, and it was the Kevin Mitnick story. Now, Kevin Mitnick, interesting little individual, have friends of mine have actually dealt with the guy. He wasn't really that smart, didn't really know that much about computers, wasn't really that good at social engineering, despite what the movie makes him out to seem like. But he ran his mouth and would basically do almost anything to get fame. So he made him a good target to, you know, for basically both his friends, well, his, he didn't really have many friends. A lot of people didn't really like him. They just, you know, strung him along behind his back. And it was, you know, anyway, had fun with the guy. Basically, several of his friends got a hold of Promise, the actual core source code for Promise. Okay? And what happened from that point was Kevin Mitnick stole the code off of one of their servers and wiped their drive. And it ended up being a whole little hacking war and garbage. And, you know, he basically also at the same time had gained access to a code, basically a piece of Promise that was, you know, unencrypted at the time, that allowed him to, and basically anyone who had it, to utilize a function, a Promise feature, I should say, in the cell carrier networks. It basically was a code built in by Nokia, Qualcomm, and several, and you know, AT&T and several others, that allowed police and law enforcement to dial into your cell phone and trunk it without anyone knowing, so that they could listen in just by, you know, knowing a specific set, code and, you know, access codes, kind of like a username and password. So if they had a password to the Promise system, they could get in, and this is one facet of it. So he had access to this, and they claim that he used this little piece of the Promise system. Meanwhile, granted, they have control of the whole thing, so they could have shut him down at any time, and every time he accessed it, they had control, and they could have changed his passwords. So it's all bull. So basically, they knew that he had got that his friends had gotten a hold of Promise. The government itself knew that he was a braggart and basically used him sort of as a patsy. They wanted him, he got the code, they wanted to see if he could crack the code because, well, at the same time, while they didn't necessarily want it to leak, they were hoping that maybe it might leak, which would give them, you know, the ultimate sheer false flag of all. You know, look, this piece of code, blah, 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 and, you know, now it's in the hands of hackers. This is perfect. You know, we can blame it on anybody. Meanwhile, we just change all the codes in the background, so those codes are all broken, don't work anymore, and then we have plausible deniability. But it never happened. He never managed to crack it. He went as far as to come to North Carolina, managed to use the knowledge that he had and the access that he had already gained, you know, in the Promise software, which was essentially given to him, to base, you know, because he's a really, you know, and it, the movie harps on his social engineering and how he's a wonderful hacker and this charming person who can, you know, talk the socks off anybody. And basically, you know, he was none of that. He was just a fat slob who was very arrogant. And he managed to get himself access to NC Wren. NC Wren is basically the North Carolina Research Electronic Network. I forget what the EN stands for. It's the predecessor for the GIG. It is the prototype for the GIG. All of the GIG's technologies get tested first in North Carolina on NCRN. Why, you might ask? Well, that's because this little spot in North Carolina called RTP has more fiber in the ground than Silicon Valley, has more IT tech companies in it than Silicon Valley, has more drug companies than most other places in the entire country, in fact, in the entire world. Glaxo, BASF, Bayer, and a slew of others are there. General Electric, RAND, IBM, Sun, Oracle are also there, just to name a few. It's Research Triangle Park. You can look it up. And about 4 years ago, I'd say, it's maybe three, it surpassed Silicon Valley for revenue. Okay? This is the core of IT. The core of IT is not in California. It hasn't been since the 90s. Since Silicon Valley had its big boom in the 80s and went bust, that was the end. It moved to North Carolina, of all places. Now, NC Wren, because it was a grid, because it was, oh my gosh, a gridded gig of, you know, sorry, micro gig. It was, you know, the gig's prototype. Had all of these supercomputers on a gig that talked to each other. So it had the compute power of, you know, the only compute. It was basically the only system he could find that had the compute power necessary to crack the encryption on Promise's source code. Imagine that. So he came all the way to North Carolina to try to get it done, and apparently, according to the news and what they say, they managed to catch him before he managed to crack it. And in the end, they make it out like they were watching him, and, you know, basically, you know, the whole point that, you know, he thought he was uploading it somewhere else to save it, and he was really uploading it to a tracer and all of that. Well, that was pretty much true, except from the get-go, they were probably letting him upload it to tracers and just merely, you know, giving him back access to that same, you know, trace, you know, to that same little honeypot, as they call them, basically, which is, you know, a honeypot in computer security is basically like a trap. It's, you know, you put out a pot of honey for a bear, you know, and you put it in a bear trap. So, you know, the bear goes, grabs the honeypot, the bear trap plunges, closed on his arm, and he's caught. You know, same idea. You know, except electronically and, you know, digitally and that sort of thing. Okay.
So basically they catch him, and there's this whole hubbub. We caught this amazing hacker. He had this thing. He stole this government, you know, this source code that, you know, blah, blah, blah. Do amazing things. It's a good thing that he never released it because it's a back, could, you know, basically a virus that could create backdoors into any system. which was essentially Promise. And it was used by the government to basically further P-TECH evolved into P-TECH and was essentially the very core software that allowed all of these wonderful, you know, SAA computers and banking systems and all of these other systems to be controlled by one single entity on 9/11. So basically, he had in his possession, and this is what made Mitnick special, the very source code that had the right hand actually gotten a hold of it and been able to access it in time, might have been able to actually disassemble and completely destroy their entire AI system, basically setting them back by another 30 years. But since that didn't happen and they managed to quote-unquote catch him, and, of course, ran a dragnet and caught all of his little friends. Yeah, that's the part they don't tell you in the movie, is that basically after he was arrested, all of the people who were associated with him that were the people who really got into software were arrested and sent to jail. Meanwhile, Mitnick ends up spending a few years in jail and gets out and now runs an IT consulting company that does consulting for the NSA, the CIA, and the DOD. Imagine that. Meanwhile, his friends are still rotting in jail. Now, yet another thing that isn't shown in that movie. Now, let's get off Hackers 2 and go on to Hackers 3. Which is interesting because it's just basically a bunch more of Hollywood drama, and it's all made to demonify basically Microsoft, the company itself that is the target of the movie called Hackers Antitrust. Is very similar to Microsoft, except instead of just, you know, hostile takeovers, the head of the Microsoft-like company assassinates people and steals their code, which, you know, is meant to demonify software makers and major software corporations. So that basically, you know, the public doesn't actually, you know, doesn't fully trust the security or the systems put out by Microsoft. Now, this can work twofold, of course. You know, if they were to truly distrust it enough to stop using it, then their whole plan would be killed. But, you know, since it's a movie, of course, nobody really, you know, lends any credence to that. Yeah, Microsoft really couldn't have a backdoor in all of my systems. Oh, no. You know, they're just incompetent, you know. But at the same time, you know, they set that up. And, you know, believe me, I'm sure Bill Gates has had many a person murdered in his time. His friend Billary liked to make it a regular event, apparently, and even go as far as to, you know, have 12-year-olds, you know, look like they fall asleep on railroad tracks whenever they so happen to watch Mrs. Clinton do drug deals with her friends. That was an interesting Fox News piece that, you know, came out before they got elected that was suppressed. And memory serves, the reporter who put together that article is also dead now. How convenient. But, yeah, that's a little off topic, but, yeah, there we go. I mean, a lot of the movies out there are meant to basically condition the public to believe that, you know, what they want them to believe. That, you know, the average hacker and the average cyber geek is your 14-year-old kid who grows up to be the 35-year-old slob who lives in his mother's basement, who has no life, who has no job, who never really gets anywhere in life. And, you know, that's the couldn't be the farthest thing from the truth. The average kid who's into computers, who spends his childhood in computers, grows up to have a job working for companies like IBM, making $50 to $60 an hour, never having to worry about handouts from anybody, never having to really steal unless they really want to and they're, you know, a kleptomaniac, never having to do anything but actually work and becomes a productive member of the society, believe it or not. Because that's one of the few industries where experience outweighs degrees. People will come out of college night and day, and I've seen it time and again. The guy who comes out of college is the first one off the job site because he has no clue what the heck he's doing. He's doing it by the textbook, it doesn't work, and he doesn't know how to fix it without his textbook. And those are the people who basically don't get the jobs, and those are the people who get pissed off, and those are usually the people who get put into managerial roles. Isn't that interesting? And there's, yes, but the point is that, you know, by demodifying these people who would grow up to be, or who grow up to be actual outstanding members of the community, you grow up to be IT personnel of the future, are able to do things, and these are the real hackers, you know, you're basically convincing the population that being smart is a bad thing. It's yet another way to create a population that believes intelligence is bad. And that's, you know, part of our whole culture. They make fun of smart people. The nerd, the geek, is the guy with glasses and suspenders who can never get a girl. You know, unless it's Revenge of the Nerds.
Yeah, that's a good point, Josh.
Yeah. So, yeah, and that's good.
Yeah, in the limited time that we have, there's several things I want to mention real quick. I'll just kind of amalgamate them together, and then Josh can comment on this however he wants to. This is one of the things here. I want to talk about teleworking because it ties into this is part of the problem reaction solution thing that goes with the flu and the rollout of Internet 2. There's an official document from Homeland Security. I'm just going to read to you what it is right here, and I will put this up later on the along with the podcast source information. This is by the Undersecretary for Management, Elaine C. Duke. This was from September 10th of this year. The subject is Telework Week, September 21st through September 27th, 2009. Quote, I encourage you to have managers and supervisors review their continuity of operations, parentheses, COOP plans and telework agreements with eligible employees, and then have as many employees as feasible spend at least one day teleworking during the week of September 21st, 2009. This telework week is an opportunity to test continuity of operations procedures as well as the capability of our information technology infrastructure. As part of this week-long test, it is important that managers and supervisors ensure telework agreements are in place for employees who fall into mission-critical status. Being able to telework is an important part of our preparedness, planning for contingencies such as the current H1N1 pandemic. It is also an opportunity to advocate telework as a business strategy that can have a positive impact on morale and improve organizational efficiency. For more information, visit the DHS Telework website, and there's a link to that. Now, backing up for a second, going back talking about Strong Angel 3 for a moment, okay? There was a question that was posed to the organizers of Strong Angel 3 that is in the PDF file, and I will read to you what it says. Question, why was the particular scenario of a spreading contagious virus and simultaneous cyber attack chosen for Strong Angel 3? Is there an indication of increased threat against the U.S. and or participating nations regarding these kinds of dangers? And the answer was this. Quote, the pandemic and cyber attack scenarios were selected from a range of possibilities because they gave the simplest and most relevant opportunity to exercise resilience, self-reliance, and transboundary cooperation. I'll let you figure out what that is. I mean, that's transboundary cooperation. welcome to CWID. Welcome to the purpose of the CWID drills, coalition task forces. In Northern Command's official documents, I've mentioned this even to Alex Jones. Well, no, I didn't mention it. I was trying to get on the air to his show about this. I've made this public, well known on the forums, and now I guess it's even more than this. But in Northern Command's official documents from 07 and 08, and possibly 06, they publicly, you know, they openly admit that they are, that they have the forces in the, in enclaves, and what they call enclaves, comprising of at least six other nations other than the United States, the echelon nations, including Finland, and maybe one other one. And all of these are integrated through their communications infrastructure is all routed through something called MNIST-JPO, which is a multinational information sharing joint program office in Arlington, Virginia, the headquarter, the communications headquarters for global martial law and mass genocide across the world. That's where it'll be run through MNIST-JPO. I mean, they tell you all their stuff. I mean, it's there's multiple references to the implementation, to the, you know, the these exercises with flu plus cyber attack. It's not just the source I mentioned there. You can do a search for that on the internet and find numerous references. Booz Allen Hamilton in 2006 ran computer simulation drills of the same things. And the other thing that ties into this too is you have... People don't realize this. This is one of the things that everybody needs to understand, okay? The New World Order has conditioned the American people that drills are a normal part of daily life. Like, there's just, they're just a quote, routine drill, like that guy at the Potomac there that was on TV when Obama was nearby and they were saying that a gun was fired or something off of a ship. What part? Okay, here's the thing. There are no, all of these drills are, they're all precursors to false flags. They're all executed so that they can be able to carry out false flags, so they can have culpable or plausible deniability. They're all illegitimate. Instead of just, instead of going out and protesting the Federal Reserve and every, and so forth, there should be people protesting drills. If you hear national level exercise 09, there should have been 100,000 people out there telling FEMA to go to hell. Tell Northern Command, exactly, go to hell. You're unconstitutional. You're high, you're traitors. Get the hell out of the United States. General Renard, he needs to be arrested. Get these people out of here. You're not protecting the United States, okay? If you do, if you do searches and you do searches for the quote, the term red team, you're going to find out that, you know, they have multiple, there's hundreds of references to red teams being used, and they actually will just admit that they've successfully carried out attacks. There's a real significant thing where there was a test that Homeland Security did, and this is real important too. I want Josh to talk about this before we run out of time. Where they ran a cyber attack test against like a $1 million diesel generator, okay? And they blew the generator up. And the video was leaked to CNN. This was like last year, I believe, okay? And it was originally for official use only. DHS slapped it with classified. The video is no longer available. I've looked for it, unless someone can imagine to find it. It shows there's pictures of the generator blowing up. And this is very serious because what they did, and we talked about this in Piercing the Darkness, they changed the AC sine wave frequency to deviate substantially enough from its 60 hertz sine wave to cause the damn thing to explode. Now, they can use the enterprise, the backdoor AI on all the systems, or, you know, hack into the power grid, like I have evidenced in... That was done in 2003 with Promise in the Northeast. You know what they could do, folks? They don't need to use EMP. They don't need to set off a nuke 200,000 feet up in the air. All they have to do is change the AC sine wave frequency to your power, and every piece of your electronics will be destroyed in your house. Everything will be gone instantly.
5 hertz. That's the deviation. 5 hertz.
It's a, it's within, you know, there's a tolerance of 45 to 60 hertz on all electrical devices. If you go to 40 hertz or 65 hertz, you are precisely out of range, just enough to make everything glow. 5 hertz, not hard to do. Really not hard to do. I mean, yeah, it can be done with a simple ham radio, even. Now, granted, ham radios cost a bunch of money, and I dang sure don't have one, but... yes, and that's the thing, is that the entire grid, and that was the whole point, and this was one of the other key facets as to why Mr. Rockefeller and Westinghouse and the rest of these people had problems with Tesla's idea of wireless power, you see. Because had things been built to his specs, you would have the converter for the power on every device, and every device would be able to determine exactly what type of power it needed at what frequency, you see. And that would actually create complete security against this sort of thing. However, because you have wires, and everything has to be tuned to exactly the same exact frequency, because if it's not, the whole thing goes haywire, and you see, you know, tuning it just out of whack on this end will cause harmonic vibration throughout the whole system. So you could literally do it at the power plant, one power plant, and have entire grids go down. Miles and miles and miles away.
There's a yeah. Specific term.
Kind of like the 2003 blackout, you know, the one where that rogue generator they say in Ohio just happened to have a mass over short of power. Yeah, the one that from the seams of the site actually more than likely almost melted. Down. Yes, the wife and I were actually through that area right about that time, and you could tell the whole place was radiation lined. I mean, it was ridiculous. I mean, didn't have a Geiger counter with me, but whenever I got back, I had a friend of mine go over the car, and he's like, there's some pretty high radiation levels. Are you guys anywhere weird? Yeah. But basically, the point being is they had a nice little blackout there, you know, in 2002, 2003. It would be very easy to create a sine wave loop condition in, you know, the electrical equipment managing, you know, that generator, and the cascade effect would just trickle down the power lines because it's all harmonics. And it's already been put out. You know, it's kind of like you drop a pebble in the water, the ripples, you know, keep going. Once you've dropped it, it's too late. The ripples ripple through. Same principle, same effect, except you're dealing with pieces of steel, which vibrate much, much faster. So it happens X many times faster. And that's the key.
Exactly.
So, go ahead.
Yeah, I just want to mention there's the electronics that were specifically mentioned in this attack on this generator. And where there's a lot of, you will see this term come up in a lot of documents. You can search for this term along with InfraGuard or CSIS, or type in James Lewis and this term, and you'll see all kinds of stuff. It's SCADA, S-C-A-D-A, which means Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition. These are the control mechanisms and power distribution components that they are talking about need to be completely re-engineered from the ground up and put on the internet. They're complaining that they're not on the internet. We need to have them on the internet so we can, in, you know, get everything on, you know, to into where we can access it from a control command center somewhere.
All right, guys, we have 5 minutes left, so any final comments or things you'd like to point out for the listeners before we wrap up?
Yeah, a couple things that I'd like for people to be aware of, that there are several state legislatures that are considering bills that would make vaccination for the H1N1 pandemic flu mandatory. Find out if your state is one of them and try and do everything you can to get a grassroots movement moving to oppose it. And on the cyber note, we've gotten into so much depth this evening, it'd be hard to really pick one thing to
target and try and rehash in the limited amount of time we have, but go ahead and research the things we've talked about. Throw them into Google and look it up. I mean, don't believe things we say. Look it up. Look it up for yourselves. We, you know, have done the research and we've looked into things, but at the same time, you know, we aren't perfect, and, you know, we do our best to make sure everything's accurate and everything is to, you know, the T as best we can. So, you know, there are people who complain that, well, why doesn't this thing happen at this time or that time? And you've got to realize that there are many documents out there, and timelines are the one thing that are impossible to pinpoint. So that's the one thing that we don't try to go by too much, but we do have lots of sources that confirm basically those, as well as everything else, you know, that's fully documented and fully accredited. So I leave it at that.
And Mark, do you have anything to add?
I just wanted to mention that, you know, the term telework, and that might seem like it's not too clear what the significance of that is, but the whole gist of that is that it's part of this illegitimate preparedness thing. I mean, it's 100% the result of their planned false flag, where they're talking about critical, you know, personnel that operate critical infrastructure, like, you know, say like the ISP backbones, or the, you know, the internet service providers, and or just first responders, or people that work in the Department of Defense and so forth, or people, employees that work at the power companies, for example, they're saying that you need to be able to manage your duties as in your job remotely, and they've been working on this for many years, and the idea of it is that you know, from the way they're saying it, is that, well, these areas, you know, in case if we're going to be quarantining people, well, that means that there's obviously not going to be any people physically in these various areas. So, well, how is the country going to keep running, right? Well, the answer is remotely, through these routers and so forth, that like Juniper Networks has all these IPv6 Homeland Security Directive compliant protocols, to where they can enable classified information access from home.
Yeah.
If you want to comment on that.
Well, yeah, they have all these new, remote working systems, these new VPNs and all this stuff. And yes, IPv6, you know, facilitates that and makes that a lot more powerful. And, yes, Juniper is at the forefront of that. They are, you know, one of the top people in this. And, you know, they've just come out with a new, web accessible VPN system that makes it easy enough so the average, employee, all they need is a web browser, and it basically does everything for you, establishes the remote tunnel. All you need is your login and password. You know, granted, the password can be substituted for key fob or any means of secure authentication mechanism that one should choose, but that's the point. You know, they are at the forefront of making VPN technology accessible to the common person, and they've done a really bang-up job of it. And that facilitates this whole thing. That facilitates the whole telework and facilitates their whole objective.
So, all right.
There you go.
Okay, all right, guys. Well, we are out of time, so it's been a pleasure having you on, as always. And, of course, I'd like to remind my listeners, anyone who's listening to this right now, that they can go to the CorbettReport.com homepage and look under the documentation for this interview to find a link to the thread on the Prison Planet forum that will contain this all of the documents and things that we've talked about today. So, guys, it's great having you on once again, and I'd like to thank you for being here and sharing your wonderful research.
Ah, it's been a pleasure, James. Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure, James. Thank you.